This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I want to thank you listeners for coming back every week and for listening to this podcast, and we are now celebrating our 498th podcast here with Pat Hazel, part two of our conversation. Next week, we're going to have another exciting guest leading up to our 500th episode, and I have had this in the can for a while, and it's very exciting. For those of you who are subscribing to the newsletter, you probably know or will know who is coming up for the 500th, and it's going to be pretty darn awesome. But this week, we actually have this podcast that is sponsored by someone who is celebrating their 50th, that's right, their 50th birthday. I want to give a big happy birthday shout out to Bruce J. Lish. Happy birthday, Bruce. He's a magician, time traveler, and a canine psychic. How about that? Be sure to check out his website, thebrooklynmagician.com. And then you should also try and check out his regular blog he puts out each month. It's called thebrooklynmagician.blogspot.com. That's BLOGSPOT.com. thebrooklynmagician.blogspot.com. Bruce Lish, also known as Dr. Veer Latus Dentum, is a magician, a time traveler, a canine psychic, and he brings you many and varied tales of his magical performances and wonderful encounters along with the ever-winding path of life. He's working hard and trying to stop and smell the proverbial roses. So please join me in wishing Bruce a happy 50th birthday here today on June 27th, 2019, and I welcome him as a paid sponsor for this shout-out, and I appreciate you as a sponsor here this week on a very special episode of number 498. And so we've got a lot to go through here with Pat Hazel in this second part. I know that you've enjoyed the first part. I've had a lot of good response from people who have gotten back to me or posted things on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere after they had heard the first part of this conversation with Pat Hazel, and looking forward to this second one. And it picks up where we left off, where we were just talking about his experience at a comedy club in Lubbock, Texas, where he was working on New Year's Eve with Terry Seabrook. So let's pick it up where we left off last week, and please welcome my guest again here this week, Mr. Pat Hazel, here on The Magic Word. Going back over to comedy, one more thing that I wanted to conclude with on, not the conversation, but at least a thought that I had before I forget it, was on New Year's when I had gone up to Lubbock, you and Terry Seabrook were working together.
That's funny. Remember that? A long time ago.
Yeah. It's a long time ago. And that would have been probably around 82, 3, somewhere, I think, in there. And came back. I went, drove up to Lubbock and watched the show, New Year's, and then next day that you guys came back with me. And I remember we stopped in a cotton field because the Terry Seabrook had never seen cotton growing. And he got out just to pick some cotton to look at it, right, to see where it actually came from. And then we came back to the house. And because it was freezing cold, I think the Olympics were on, and you and Kathy and I were in a hot tub. And I remember that your hair was like icing down. You know, I remember, said, feel my hair. And your hair was like, you know, hard as a rock because of the ice on there. But, and we're watching the Olympics. Anyhow, that, yeah, so Terry was there and it was fun. And he was making fun because you'd lost your check.
I did lose my check. You know, the guy was really nice. Todd, I think his name
was. Yes, that was him. Todd McCabe.
Todd McCabe. And he was a big invitation for the two of us to play New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
There was something strange. It was, I don't know how that club was designed or whatever, but it was like the housing was in the club. Like it used to be some other kind of bar place where there were some apartments, two apartments in it or something.
Hotel room or something. That's weird. Okay.
Because I remember that when he said at the end of the night, we're going to lock you in here. Like, we're closing up. You're going to be in here for the night. Like, oh, that's weird, you know. But it was chaos. It was a great. I don't know. Were you at the actual? I think we did two shows. So you might come to the early show.
I think it might have been the earlier show, yeah.
So they paid me before the late show.
Okay.
And because they said, it's going to be crazy here. It's going to be chaos. So I had a check.
Yeah.
Somewhere. And then the show was over and there was confetti and there were streamers and there were drunks and there were, it was a madhouse.
As you can imagine on most any New York bar.
So I now am packing my stuff up, and I know that we're going to be there, whatever, and I cannot find the check for the life of me. And I feel so stupid because I know it was given to me.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'm going to ask the guy or not ask the guy or wait a week and call him and, you know, whatever. I was just, and I decided, well, I'm here and it's here. I'm going to tell him. So I tell him, and everybody, every waitress, everybody is digging through confetti and trying to find this check and whatever. And we're like, no check, you know? Yeah. And I was like, ah, and he goes, well, we'll figure it out. We'll make do, whatever. I mean, they ended up mailing me a check and it worked out fine, but it was months later. Mm-hmm. Months and months, months later that he found the check, and he had, it was in, like, I had a promo kit at the time that was open on his desk, and it had all my picture and my whatever. Mm-hmm. And somehow when he wrote it out and set it there or did whatever, or we were doing a card trick, something happened. The promo kit got closed. It got put in the files. Like my New Year's Eve check was eventually found, but it was a long time after that.
Well, I'm glad you finished that story, because I remember the whole time that week that we were at the house that Terry kept making fun of you about losing your check.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad story, but...
Well, sorry to bring that up then, but I thought...
But the funny thing is, I did think I lost it.
And I thought that you found it in your suitcase. It was like
No, I didn't find it in my suitcase, so, but I thought that I had lost it, and therefore I had to own that it wasn't their responsibility. Like that, that's the part of it where I don't know what I was thinking at the time. Easily he could have voided it and written another check.
Sure,
but, I thought, you know what? It was in my hand. I took responsibility for it.
When you set it down, it just happened to be on top of that folder.
Yeah, I mean, it ended up in the pocket of that folder and whatever.
No, I didn't hear the follow-up. Yeah. Sorry. Well, I'm glad to know that, but sorry to have brought it up.
No, it's fine. I think I spent it. But I do remember at that particular thing, both Terry and I, you used your, that was early video camera technology up on the shoulder there, and you were videotaping some things for us, one or two things that I put in one of the symposium
books,
New York symposium books for Adam Flesher, I guess. And I had not done that before. I had not published any of my tricks or anything. Mm-hmm. And I did a few different things, and you.
Yeah. I videoed that as well. I got a picture of you somewhere. I had a big peacock chair and Terry was sitting in it and you were standing behind it, you know, with your top hat, kind of, you know, I'm going to have to dig that out. Maybe I can put that on the blog if I can.
Yeah.
Find
you've shared that with me sometime over the last number of years.
I think maybe that I have somewhere along the way. And so, you also produced, we talked about Wonder Bread years. We touched on that briefly. I recall that was supposed to have played many years ago, like after the Super Bowl was over in certain markets.
Not the Wonder Bread years.
Okay, what was the Bunkbed Brothers?
The Bunkbed Brothers was the play that got made into a sitcom called American Pie, which was came from the Bunkbed Brothers, and it was not Super Bowl. It was a World Series game that they...
Boy, am I confused.
No, that's fine. But it was one of these things that was, you know, NBC had produced six episodes, and they didn't know what to do with it, and they were waiting to see when they were going to put it on the air. Mm-hmm. And... my recollection is that a World Series game ran short on the East Coast. And so they were like, oh, no.
We need some time.
They did that, and they didn't know what to do, but they knew they were moving to Mountain Time. They were moving to Pacific.
Right.
They weren't going to have enough to fill before the next show went on. And so that, you know, that would have been in the fall, you know, that the World Series was on.
Yeah.
And so it was a weekend, and some dude at NBC didn't know what to do, and my show was done. Yeah. And so they pulled one episode out. I don't know how they do it. They racked it up, and it just suddenly was following the World Series in some market, I think in Mountain Time and Pacific Time. But by the time I found out about it, you know, it was half over in Colorado.
Yeah.
And people were like, we're watching your show after the World Series. What's going on?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, I can at least call the people in California or something and say, it's on tonight. Yeah. I don't know why, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
What that weird accident turned out to be one of the worst parts of being able to get that show on the air.
Really?
And I didn't know it until after the fact. But that guy had made an executive decision, whoever it was. He wasn't like the head of the network or something. Yeah.
He was just in the control room.
He was the control room dude that works weekends during the World Series. Like, this was Christmas help, right?
Filling time.
The lowest member of the NBC cast system was okay. Like, well, this looks good. It's funny. Whatever. Okay. So what I found out is that, therefore, it didn't run in all the markets, so they couldn't really run numbers on it, so they couldn't see how it did.
Oh, bummer.
So they didn't have statistics. And then it was done by NBC Productions, which was a production company, and it aired on NBC, the network, which didn't own the show.
Okay.
So we could have sold it to ABC or CBS or anywhere. We could have taken it.
Through the production company.
The production company could have.
But now that it played on the network...
Right. Gotcha. So when we met with the other networks, they said, oh, have any of these aired? Because they kind of liked it.
Yeah.
And they said, well, one did, kind of, you know, whatever. And that sort of damaged the package.
Oh, man.
You know, and it was like, what? And they're like, yeah, well, why would we put something on that NBC didn't like enough to put the others on? Like, it was right. A very, very awkward life lesson to have gone through
wow.
To find that out. And therefore, it was sort of not available. And the head of NBC changed.
Yeah.
And what happens in that situation is the new guy doesn't want the old guy stuff. Because if
correct.
It gets credit, then the old guy was the genius, right?
Right. And he's got to make his own way.
Right. And if he puts it on, it's a bomb, then he's blamed for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it would just got caught.
Everything to lose, nothing to gain.
Right. However, I did. It was 6 episodes of executive producing, creating, writing, starring. Like, it was film school. I learned yeah. how to make these episodes, and I met amazing directors and costumers and everyone else. And it was more what I wanted to do. I mean, I wanted to create original content and try to get America to laugh, you know?
Right.
It just, it never really made it to the audience.
And then after that, there was another series that you'd worked on? Wasn't that right, that you were trying to put together?
Well, I've worked on a number of different things after that, and some of them were for other people.
But nothing for you specifically?
Not for me, no.
Okay. So the other thing I guess I'm thinking of was the tour that you did have, the Bunk Bed Brothers. Is that right?
Bunk Bed Brothers, still a show that goes out. Wonder Bread Years goes out. Mm-hmm. I wrote a show called Kodachrome Christmas, which tours.
So you've got guys doing this?
Sometimes, yeah.
Okay.
And I do the Wonder Bread Years, but there was a time that multiple people, I think at the heat of it, I had 5 people performing the show in different parts of the country,
yeah.
Essentially a franchised or licensed act that I directed, and then we would pay the performers from, which
right.
was, you know, a great way to detach yourself from caring so much, you know.
Yes.
And that was during raising my kids years. You know?
Yeah, that's right. And as you had said earlier, that was something that's really more retro kind of a thing, talking about your early childhood and everything, which those, again, who were at Magic Live in 2018 saw a little bit kind of what you're doing when you were showing some of the videos and the slides.
Family slideshows and stuff. I like to work with multimedia.
Yes.
And it's interesting because that serves somewhat the same as props served in a magic show.
Good point.
Like, I'm able to tell a story and have the punchline happen on the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's a bit of an art to it.
Yeah. Because people were asking me later about this, that was just doggone hilarious. That was so much fun. And he said, do you think those were really from his family? I said, I know they were. I've met some of the people.
Yeah. You know? Well, in fact, the new piece that I'm writing right now, which will debut in Des Moines,
mm-hmm.
it opens December 3rd, and I do 21 shows in Des Moines.
Wow.
Is a show called Pat Hazel's Permanent Record.
Okay, that's a good one.
And when I was a kid, the words, something going to end up on your permanent record, was the sure. worst thing that could happen to you.
Right, right.
You may not, you know, if they find out about that, you can't get a job, you can't do something, you're not going to go to that college. It was going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise had been floating around in my head for a while. But now that you see politicians and the Me Too movement and all of that stuff, I'm thinking, you know what? It is their permanent record.
Wait, that's true.
That's what's taking them down.
Good point. Yeah, there are so many things that are happening then right now that are present in the media that happened 20 years ago. It's like, I guess I never should have had that drink in the bar when I was underage or whatever.
Right,
you
and
know.
So you're really the author of your own permanent record. So
yeah.
I started the writing of this. I'm in the midst of it right now. It's not completed. Saying, what is my permanent record? What's on it? Where is it? Who holds that stuff?
Yeah.
If I want to clear it up, how do I tell them my side of the story and
yeah.
so forth? So I started with the hospital I was born in, the junior high. Like, do you have my permanent record, calling these places? And they just think I'm out of my mind, right?
Yeah.
So yesterday, in fact, I had my first interview. I hired what's called an opposition research firm to look into me.
Opposition research. I never
well, the
such
idea
thing.
Is that if you have a political, you're aspiring to be a congressman or a president or whatever it
you
is.
Contact them and they will find out about your
They
opponent.
Look into you.
Oh, do you?
In my case, they're looking into me.
Okay, yeah.
They might look, if we were two corporations and we were going to meld, and I'd say, what's the deal on Scott? Is his reputation going to ruin my reputation?
Yes, sir. Okay.
But sometimes you want to be ahead of it, so you would hire a person to look into you, and they go back and they look at your financial, criminal, drivers, everything, right? And right. they, how did you vote? Whatever that is for the purpose of that client.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting part of their job is they don't just show it to you. They then say, they try to tell you the narrative if it was going to be spun bad. Like, this picture doesn't look so good.
Yeah.
Here's what we see in this picture, and here's what your opponent is going to say about you. How do you explain it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of fascinating, you know?
They want to
know, did I have bad dates? Did I ever say anything racist? Did I ever say something on Twitter? Because this is my chance to tell them.
And try to expunge your record.
they don't get to
do that.
They don't expunge it.
Okay.
What happens is they go look for it. They say, oh, we'll go find that. Let's see if we can find that incident.
Yeah.
Let's see if there was a newspaper article. I mean, it's kind of strange that I even submitted the idea, but I submitted it for the purpose of the narrative to say, what does it feel like? You have to face who you are.
Yeah.
You have to face your facts, right?
Okay.
I did dumb things. We all did dumb things, right? Mm. The funny stories I hear, I go, I did that? Did I really do that? They're not even terrible stories. They're just, you know, people from high school. I remember when you did. I did? Oh, I did a lot of that crazy stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
None of it was vandalism or violent or anything else.
Funny stuff.
But, I mean, the reason I did a lot of funny stuff was because I was convinced the stories were going to be worth telling.
Okay.
Right? That's why I got in the straitjacket and I did it one time.
Yeah.
I didn't keep it in my act. I didn't keep doing it. The story, the journey was interesting. This journey is going to be interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be interesting to say, you know, to try to find evidence of things or, you know, look at moments in my life. And I think the audience is going to relate to it. They're going to relate. And I'm doing it coming into an election year and other things, you know, I mean, coming in the next couple of years. So it will have some
legs right now.
It'll have relevance in terms of present day.
Yeah.
But it will still have my nostalgic voice looking at my own past. I mean, I did things that, you know, one thing that I remember doing from high school on was I take the air sickness bag out of the seat in front of me, tear the bottom out, then fold it up and put it back in. I know. I don't know if it's funny, but I imagine one day it probably was hilarious. It paid off, right?
Not to the person who used it.
No, but who cares at that point, right? But that would, you know, the question is, oh, is that on my permanent record? If they wouldn't know that. That was me. Who knows, you know?
Right.
And I often had these weird ideas that were, you know, that I was like, oh, I wonder if this would be funny, you know?
Yeah. Well, I've had something kind of like that at the last moment that I did it, it's like it wasn't as funny as I thought, and it flashed so quickly, particularly, I'll share it with you, that I haven't with anybody else. It was Terry Squibb, and I was probably in junior high, and I pulled the chair out from underneath her as she was sitting down, and as she was starting to hit the floor, I was trying to put the chair back, thinking, this is not going to be funny, and you know, when she hit the floor, I wasn't laughing, nobody was laughing, but for some reason, as she was sitting down, I thought, this will be funny. Nope, it's not funny. You know,
that's the worst moment. Right.
Yeah. And I can't do anything about that.
Right.
You know, that's on my record.
Yeah. I did it once to myself. I used to do this thing when the check would come. We'd be with a group of people.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was funny when people would scrutinize. They'd look at how much they owe. You know, somebody always comes up short or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So I often at that time would reach for the bill, pick it up. Right. Mm-hmm. And then do this double take and like kind of, you know, push back in my chair a little bit and go, what? You know, whatever. And everybody would laugh.
Yeah.
Well, this was some crab house or something in D.C., and there was a bunch of people around the table. And when I pushed back and kind of, you know, did this double take, it was one of those floors with peanut shells on the grounds or whatever. That chair went out from under me.
Oh, my.
Like, and under the table. And I went completely back over and hit my head on the cement and whatever. Yeah. And I was like, well, I was just like, and they were laughing their heads off.
They thought it was all part of
the bit. They thought I went for it.
Yeah.
And I got up and I was a little like,
woozy.
I was woozy. and they were like, are you all right? And I had to say, yeah, No, I'm fine. Oh, I was just being funny. And I was like, oh, I'm never doing that again. Like, yeah. That was not worth it, you know?
You know, as an aside, made me think of something. I had lunch many years ago with James Randi, and he was saying when he gets a check, you put your, like, your ring finger underneath the receipt, and you flip it up, you know, so it looks like that.
There's, you know, a moment.
It's like a shock, but also that it actually shoots out of your hand, you know, like some ethereal thing had lifted up. It's like, holy cow, look at this, you know. It's like, and you kind of are in shock, and the thing actually flips up your hands, you know, kind of a thing.
Well, you know, but check humor is a very important part of, you know. No, I did. You know what? When you do a headline act in a comedy club, they drop the checks on the tables in front of you in the middle of your act. It could be at the moment you're telling the big punchline.
You're starting to wrap up,
So you have to learn to have a moment with the check. Like, you see them coming out, and it's better to say, oh, I see the checks are coming, and then you do something. One of the things I used to do is I would grab the check at the table in front of me, and I would look at it, and I would go, oh, who had the total? That was very expensive. Yeah. Like, it was a bowl of total, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they kind of laugh, and I'm like, all right, don't, you know, you kind of talk the front table through not coming up short and tip your waitresses or whatever. And then you diffuse that moment, and then you can get back to your act without that thing ruining them.
So it's, you have to recognize that, which I think is a lot of things, is that it was something that's important in comedy in general, is to recognize the level of the room and to respond to hecklers or somebody says something, because the rest of the people hear what they're saying. The same thing whenever that, if you're doing a magic trick and you happen to flash something, you're going to think, oh, hopefully they didn't see it. Yeah, they did. If you saw it, they saw it. You know, people should recognize that.
Right.
And you got to, you know, call attention to something, you know, address the elephant in the room, because people do see, they do hear.
Right.
You know, they're sentient beings, and if you saw it, they saw it or heard
it.
Yeah,
I think in all of the art, theater arts, magic, whatever it is, especially stand-up comedy, the real art is listening. You know, you're talking, but you're listening. Mm-hmm. You're listening to how they respond, how long they respond, when does the laugh crest, will I do the next thing? If they're not laughing, then you need to change subjects and whatever. If you're a good listener, you can really surf any wave, right? It's when you're not paying attention, when you're phoning it in, or when you're doing the same thing over and over and over, that you're not having fun with it. Mm-hmm. They're not having fun with it, right? But when a golden moment happens and you take that ride and the audience gets on that ride with you, they go, oh my God, how did this happen? What, this guy's never done this before. That's never happened. Yeah. They automatically feel like it's a moment just for them. And that's the one you want to search out. You know, that's the opening line that you've never said before, but you just happen to come, you know, out of the same traffic they came out of or whatever, right?
Right.
The connection is about them, not about customizing the whole act. It's about the personalization of them thinking that you're giving them a unique gift on that night, right? And I always do it in a hotel and a whatever. If I'm doing a corporate thing, and I know they're going to experience, they're walking by the same, you know, flower arrangement or Chippendales poster or whatever.
Yeah.
I usually try to make my observation on the path they were on, because they know I've never done that before.
Mm-hmm. They can relate to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's very topical, and topical meaning like within the last few minutes.
Right. Yeah. And when it's like that, it doesn't have to be hilarious. It doesn't have to be the greatest joke in the world. Mm-hmm. You get wit points for having seen it and said it. Right. And learning to trust that and not apologizing for
it. Well, that kind of comes, I think, after time. I mean, that not everybody is funny. Don't you think there are natural comedians and those? I mean, but comedy is something you can learn, certainly. But some people, are just naturally funny.
Yes, I agree with that. But I do think that if you're observant,
often, you can find funny.
Oftentimes the person introducing you, you know, struggles with a word or says your name wrong or does something. That's the moment, right? You seize the moment, and you don't do it to embarrass them.
Yeah.
You say to the audience, I'm listening. I'm paying attention, right? Mm-hmm. And that really puts them on the edge of their seat in a good way. Like they're like, oh, this guy's sharp.
That's a good comedy tip, and not just for comedy, but for magicians and their act as well. Whenever that they're, like if you hear people talking about the food or something, you know, if you're doing a corporate show or something and say, ooh, the chicken was a little not done right, or whatever, then you can make some comment about that they can relate in real time, right?
Right.
There too.
Yeah, I think that's, I find that to be really valuable. Yeah. The first time that I ever really did it, was I started hosting, doing corporate MC work for these companies. Mm-hmm. And rather than do my star turn act, they didn't really want my act. They wanted me to introduce speakers and to do a little custom monologue at the beginning. Sure. And I was like, oh, what do I got? I got to write something for tomorrow morning, tonight?
Yeah.
Oh, what am I going to do? And I basically went around the hotel room and I wrote a joke about the hotel safe. And there was a dolphin. This was in Hawaii. There was a stuffed dolphin on the bed you could buy for $14.
Okay.
And then there was, you know, the mini bar. And then I saw the suntan lotion, which was $14. And I was oh, you faced a big dilemma this morning. You got $14 left. Do you go for the dolphin or the suntan lotion? It's very hot. Like, and they laugh because something about the $14 registered, and they had had that conversation with their spouse, not that specific one.
Yeah.
And there was a shell necklace. It looked like a necklace. It was a shell lay kind of thing.
Like a puka bead thing?
Yeah. That had the card on it that you hung over your doorknob. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
It's a pretty big loop.
Okay.
And then on it, it said, do this if this, and turn it the other way if you want service. Mm-hmm. And I picked that thing up and I threw it over my neck and I dropped the card down in my shirt. So I was wearing a puka necklace, right? And then I was like, oh, did everybody get their free gift? And I slid the thing out and it came up and they just went nuts, right?
Yeah.
And all of that was found things, you know, within 24 hours of the event.
Mm-hmm.
Walking, there was a train on this property for some reason, this really super slow train to get from the rooms, and it went next to this sort of moat and this, you know, but it moved so slow you could outwalk this train, mm-hmm. right? And so I kept referring it to as the bullet train, and they were, you know, they just laugh every time, you know, right? And it was trust. It was about trust my instincts.
Yes.
See funny things, write them down, use them. Just like that, you know.
Bill Goldman. I don't know if you know Bill Goldman.
William Goldman, the screenwriter?
No. He's a magician. He worked with Bill Malone at Malone's Bar.
Okay, Malone.
Funny guy. Bill had a great close-up and had a some good lecture notes and everything out and everything then too. But he was doing a lecture one time and he just finished a trade show and he was asked to do a lecture while he was in whatever city it was. And he didn't have a lot of stuff. As I recall the story, didn't have a lot of stuff with him, but as he was leaving and they were closing the show, he found this, somebody had like a bunch of these straws that was decorating one of the booths that were long. They were like 6-foot straws. I mean, they looked like drinking straws, like a McDonald's size, you know, diameter, basically kind of a long thing, you know, like that. And they were just, you know, again, decorations for the booth. The point being is he said, you know, you're going to throw those away. What are you going to do with them? He said, yeah, we're just toss them. So he grabbed them, not knowing what he was going to do with it, and had the idea on the way, you know, said McDonald's straw. And so what he did is to get a cup. And then he kind of put a hole in the bottom of the cup, put the straw up his sleeve.
That's funny.
And so he's actually, as he comes, you know, he walks out, he's kind of drinking from that. And then he pulls the straw out and he keeps coming out and he's got a 6-foot straw that comes out of
this
cup.
That's hilarious,
basically.
Yeah.
And so he was selling these straws that he got for free. That was an idea he came up with, you know, on the way to the lecture.
That's
so
great.
But if you got a comedy mind, you start thinking about what can I do with this?
Right.
And also that you're under fire. He's thinking, okay, what can I sell, make some money when I didn't bring anything with me, you know, or something. So I
think you got to challenge yourself to that, though. You have to say, you have to keep a notebook. Like I always tell writers, you're not a writer. A writer is somebody who wrote today, mm-hmm. right? You can talk about things you're going to write, but if you don't write it down, if you don't develop stuff, then you're not really a writer at that mm-hmm. point. And you do have to write for yourself, even if you're writing a trick idea down or drawing something.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some fashion, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny because people don't have any problem doing a post or doing something that might be, you know, disposable.
That's a good point.
But again, when I used to do joke of the day on the answering machine all those years ago, that's really what the post is of today, right?
Right.
Somebody's going to go look for something funny or something meaningful or something inspiring, right?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you have to invest that time in what the muse of what you're actually trying to do. And then you have to figure out, I think John Cleese say you have to package it, because a joke you tell in a bar disappears and goes away. But you put it in a greeting card or on a bumper sticker or in an act or in a screenplay, like it becomes something you can monetize once you know how to package it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be as simple as a single joke in a Hallmark card, you know, or as elaborate as a Woody Allen movie, right? That's a stack of jokes altogether, right. Whatever. Becomes right. Dialogue, becomes something that people think about, right? And that's all, it's all just building blocks towards an act.
Right. Like the one joke that every magician or every comedian has their own spin on. There was a movie on that. What was it? The Anderson family? You know, I forgot what the name of that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Eric Mead was in the movie and some other people
sure,
you know,
the they were all told.
And Robin Williams and, Billy Crystal and everybody, they had their own twist on this particular joke.
Right. It's one of the dirtiest jokes ever told.
Correct. And you're just supposed to, people get dirtier and dirtier, you know, on that. Right. And they made a whole movie out of it. But my point being is that, you just have the one punchline, but it's what you put into that to kind of bring them on an entertaining journey. Again, going back to when I mentioned Bob Reed, telling a lot of stories before he finally actually produces a bottle, you know.
Yeah, no, Bob was funny again, and Bloom was funny. These guys, and they were good magic performers, too.
Yes.
Right. I remember, I would say that I got an early compliment from Di Vernon that made me realize, like, I was a good salesman of my content. The tricks, you know, other people did some of these tricks, some of them, some were original and so forth. But I was at some early magic contest or something. And I was like everybody else trying to do the world's greatest pass, you know, finger flinging, you know, like trying to do it so it was invisible. And he said to me, you don't need to work on that. Like, they're not looking at your hands. Those guys need to work on that because they're being scrutinized because they don't know what to do in between.
Right.
But nobody's ever looking at your hands. You could do it slow. You could do it deliberate. They'll never spot it. And I was like, oh, I got a different lesson here, right? And that was everything you do is interesting enough that we don't care what your hands are doing. And that actually eased up on the amount of, like, time I had to spend on a trick or something.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what Kathy was always telling me, you know, that spend more time talking and not doing the trick, going from trick to trick to trick, you know. I remember years ago talking with Fielding West about that. He said, what's in your act? And I said, well, I got this. And he said, yeah. And I mentioned two or three things. And then I started saying four or five things or six things. And he said, well, how long is your act?
Right.
You know,
right.
I said, it's about 45 minutes. He said, so you got 12 things in there. You know, right. He said he does like three in 45 minutes. So right. It's a journey. It's what you're saying. You just need to look at what you're saying and doing.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I think having purpose with why you pick things, I don't know how it is for people. I watch some acts now. As a consultant, I work with a lot of different kinds of performers.
Yeah.
You know, I work with magic thinkers. I work with songwriters. I work with playwrights. I work with movie people. I work with one-man shows. You know, like everybody's got a different riddle to solve. Some of it is they need to edit what they've got. They've got too much, you know, they got, you know, 10 pounds of material in a 5-pound bag, and you got to go make some choices here. Like 50% of these organs have to be taken out of the body.
Yeah.
Like I don't, it's, if it's precious to you, then we're going to have a hard time with this. But, you know, let's talk about what the point is.
It goes back to your life sometimes about hoarding. You know, that I've got a lot of stuff I need to start getting rid of in my life.
And
the older you get, the more
you
hoard, you know.
I'm kidding.
You got to start getting rid of things. And the same thing you're saying about your act, you should start whittling it down, you know, and get to the essence of it.
Yeah, understand what it is. And so, you know, it's, look, everybody's got a unique perspective of what and why they do it, right? Mm-hmm. And some people really want to fool people, and that's great.
It's fine, too.
That's a good, it's perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Like when I consult with people, I always start with the first questions, and they have nothing to do with the act. I go, tell me about what you aspire, what is your act? What do you want to do? Where do you want to go with this?
Mm-hmm.
If it's a play, whatever. If they say, I want to be famous, we have one agenda. If they say, no, but I'm saying if that's their agenda.
Okay.
If they say, I want to make more money, I want more gigs.
Okay.
And we say, okay, this is about making money, then we'll do this. If they want an artistic thing, if they want an original thing, if they want a creative thing, if they don't want to look like their peers, you know, we have deeper work to do on each level, depending on what it is.
Sure.
But sometimes people are convinced that fame is going to bring money and money is going to bring happiness and whatever.
Right.
And so I always have to then stop them and just say, okay, so what does happiness mean to you? Like if that's the goal indirectly, then let's talk about it. You want to spend more time with your kid. So maybe you don't want to be a touring act. Maybe you want to be a sit-down act. If you're a sit-down act, maybe we could take advantage of the environment. You know, if you've seen Ray Anderson at
Esther's Follies,
an extraordinary act, great tricks that have to come and go off and go on between review acts and so forth. But he has the environment to his advantage. They have to come to him, right? The way the LeGrand David show or some of those shows were about the destination of going to the thing. Other people have to be nimble enough to pick up and do a new show every night or have a bus and truck show or whatever. Mm-hmm. But all of that informs what you should do. It isn't just like, I just want to do an act. And how much work do you want to do? Like, there are people who want to, it has to pack into a matchbox, and they, if it doesn't fit in their suit pockets, it doesn't go. Mm-hmm. Fantastic goal. Other people say, I want a spectacular. I want something that competes with Cirque du Soleil. Okay. So how do we do that? What do we think is going to be bigger, better, more, you know, unusual than something else? I like all of it, as long as people can answer questions of why does it exist? What is this character? Why is this extra person in the show? Oh, they're just bringing something out to you. Okay. You have a lovely magic assistant. Is that of any value? Right. And what does it do for the person doing it? You know, and if they are, do you want them to be visible or invisible? Right. Do you want them to come out in, you know, in black and, you know, outfit and whatever, and really not be incidental? And there's good reasons for that, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
You might need that to make an effect work. But I think that's
questions they need to ask themselves. And so even if you are not, if the people who are listening to this are not fortunate enough to have a consultant such as you, they need to be introspective and answer those kinds of questions to themselves. What is your ultimate goal? Where are you going to be going? I mean, I've said that to people for a long time. You know, have a plan. What is your 1 year plan? Where do you want to be next year, three years, 5 years, 10 years? You know, what is the long term? And also, why do you want to be at those places? So what is your goal? If it's ultimately happiness, what defines happiness? I mean, you've asked those good questions.
Right? Well, I think the number one thing that you can have a sense of pride in is originality, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
So even if you're using principles and so forth, that's fine. That's what we all live on, understanding the principles of gravity and various things that we can mess with. But in terms of the voice of the show, the look of the show, all of that, the more original you are, the less you're going to be afraid that you're going to walk on stage at a club or a magic convention or something, and somebody's just going to have done the thing right before you. Mm-hmm. That's a disaster.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you're inviting that situation. The same as a songwriter. If you're doing a cliche song that sounds like other people's songs, you know, you're never going to have what Steve Martin says is a reason for people to engage you. Right. He talks about, you know, having a bulletproof reason for people to hire you, right?
Right.
You know, it's other words he uses, but the point is that you have to be undeniably interesting, right?
Okay.
At that point.
I think that everybody has a story and everybody's interesting. You just need to find those things that are interesting. When they say everyone has a good book in them, I don't think they may have a second book. Some people do.
Right.
But everybody has at least one good book in them.
Some people thinner books.
Yeah, thinner.
But it is interesting that you also don't have to be an expert in every field. Mm-hmm. You know, we just talked about the passing of the great Johnny Thompson, and he was a consultant for people, problem solving and whatever. And if you need a secret weapon and you go to a person that can help you solve a problem, that's not wrong, right?
Right.
Right. If you need a comedy writer or if you need a choreographer, you're not expected to be a great dancer or whatever, but maybe they can give your act some elegance, right? If you go to a good designer, if you go to a Jim Steinmeier, if you go to some of these people, right, it's okay. Like you move towards that final place to put yourself on the map.
And it's important, I think, to recognize that you can't and shouldn't do it all yourself, because a lot of people think, well, I can design that, or I can do my own website, or I can sew this costume, or I can build this illusion. Maybe yes and maybe no, but that also means guns or butter, simple economics. You could do one or the other, and that means to the detriment of maybe doing the show because you're out marketing the show. So you need to actually hire those people who are professionals who can do it better and take you to that next level, because they're the ones who can do the marketing, make the website, build the illusions, whatever, and you got time to actually go and do the shows with the stuff that they've helped to get you there.
Right. And it may be a business partner, right? You may have a great act and not a great business mind, or may not be. Like, I represent a couple of people and I wouldn't say ghost represent. I mean, I've
the Sweetbird Productions.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My company, I represent some authors and some other people mm-hmm. who are great storytellers. They're great writers. They're not great negotiators. They're not a good business person per se, but now they don't think about it. Right.
Right. They need to.
They have a book deal. They have a something. We get that stuff in place. They get to go write the book. They're a rock star when it comes time to right. talk about the book and so forth. Right. But what they don't like to do is network. They don't like to, you know, do certain things.
Sure.
But they're an amazing speaker if you have them on a conference, or, you know, they can mm-hmm. tell you every little detail there is about story writing or podcasting or something, right?
Right. But, got a specialty.
Yeah.
Of some sort.
So, you know, it's an interesting thing. I negotiate because of all these national touring shows with theaters and stuff all the time.
Yeah.
There's so much of that business vernacular and the culture of what to do and how to charge and what's the price point and all of that. And they don't care about the first, they're lucky to have their ID on them when they get on the airplane. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
It doesn't make them, they have an artist brain, right?
Right.
So,
right. They don't think in the marketing. And I know so many people like that who I think could take it to another level if they had the right people behind them, because they are so darn creative and they are
right.
very entertaining. But, you know, I'm wondering, why aren't they at that level? I mean, I see some people, okay, I'm not a big Kevin Costner fan, but he got to his position someplace somehow. And I think there are a lot of actors that are not at doing the work he is or getting the opportunities he has, but are much better actors than he is. You know right. what I'm saying?
And but here's the interesting thing. And this is where fame has value, right? Sometimes there's a tipping point of selling a movie. It's the same with an American Idol person ends up in a Broadway show or whatever. They do have the first shot because they can sell tickets.
Because the name brand.
The name brand.
Gotcha.
And that doesn't happen from the get-go. But at a certain point, if you have a couple of giant hits and you become this go-to guy, it's mm-hmm. really the parlay. I would say in magic, it's the one-ahead principle. Okay.
Yeah.
The one ahead principle is the greatest thing that you can learn for yourself. If everybody knows the trick, put the deck of cards behind your back, flip one card over, right? And then you know one thing ahead of the audience. You
yeah.
know it's the two of diamonds coming up next, so you can say, you go behind your back and you bring it forward, you go two of diamonds. Now you're looking at the three of clubs, right?
Right.
You will know one more thing than the audience knows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the information you have to go through that whole deck of cards if you felt like it, right?
Yes, right.
So in business or in comedy or in writing, any of those things, you may have just written a hit play, but what's the next thing? What are you most interested in next while that's trying to be made, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because then you always have that one thing. When somebody says to me, what do you want to do? I say, I'm working on Permanent Record now, right? It may not be my thing they can buy a ticket to yet, but it is the thing that gives me purpose and passion and focus.
Right.
Because I'm not, I don't know, whatever. If something happens, that'd be great. You know,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people do wait for the phone to ring.
Yeah.
They hope that another call from another area. They hope a friend refers them. They literally don't know the next thing they're going to do.
They're just waiting for something to happen and that domino to drop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm.
But I think the thing is, if you build an arsenal of things you're interested in and you're careful not to do them all at once, not to go, I'm spinning this ball and this ball and this ball and this ball. But if you have the one ahead principle in play, when I was a studio audience warm-up comedian mm-hmm. and it wasn't the greatest job in the world, it paid well, but it's a tough job to interact with the audience.
Yeah.
I was collecting that money to produce my first play. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the one ahead was, oh, this brings value to that.
Okay.
So now when I'm putting this play on, I wasn't just putting on a play and hoping whatever. My purpose of putting the play on was I want to sell the screenplay to a movie company. So how do I get not an audience every night? How do I get the one big fish to come to this play while it's running this summer?
Mm-hmm.
Who is that big fish? Oh, is it a network? Is it a studio? Whatever. It turned out that we got Columbia TriStar to come to a little theater with 60 seats, and their executives saw this.
Mm-hmm.
Saw this as a possible movie. And then it was the getting the LA Times reviewer into a seat who wrote a great, you know, funniest new kids on the block headline. One person is all we needed to print it in the paper, who then,
get the
you know,
ball rolling.
Right. So then that made other people say, what's the heat on this play? Right. So we're always one ahead on the purpose of what our action is. It isn't to, like, at the end of the night, take a bow and walk away. It's like, okay, what are we doing? Are we are we taping tonight's show because we're going to use it as a marketing tool to sell into more markets? Is it, you know, is this the night we're going to get our still photos taken? Like, what, how are we doing? I never went on the Tonight Show unless I had something to promote. If I right. didn't have an upcoming show, it seemed like a bad idea, right? To just be on and be funny. If I could say, this week from this to this, I will be at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach. Now there's a, you know, there's momentum.
Well, that's what I was saying about America's Got Talent, because a lot of guys that will go on there, then
it's
now
good.
Will say,
it's smart.
I will only do that if I've got an agenda of something that I want to go to the next level.
Right.
Because I'm not necessarily expecting I'm going to go all the way to the end and win $1 million, but I want to do
It's good
X,
exposure.
Y, Z.
I have yes. to say, Variety X are not getting the airtime other ways.
That's true.
If they're not on America's Got Talent, or if they're not on X Factor, or, you know, Last
and
Comic
even so
Standing.
That, because the competition that you have with so many other networks and pay-per-view, et cetera, you know, HBO, whatever, you don't have that going way back to our early conversation talking about the networks when you just had a few networks and so you had good share. You know, now if you get, you're not going to get a 1% share on anything anymore.
Well, here's the funny thing. The networks are not the big dog anymore.
Yeah, it's really
it's
more
Netflix.
I was going to say Netflix.
I want to. If somebody
Amazon
wants a special
Prime.
On Netflix and they want their voice heard,
yeah.
it's archived there. You can promote. Go right. see my show. Go see my show.
Yeah, look at Nate Bargatze. You know, I mean,
he's great.
Yeah,
Nate's hilarious.
Yes,
and you know, finally now has this special, The Tennessee Kid.
Right,
and
it's
his dad.
Funny.
You know, like that's something that people will be able to see his voice now. You know, is the agency, are the people representing him able to parlay the running time, the Netflix special? He should have other things, you know, and I'm sure
right.
he does, that are, you know,
the next thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You know, another thing that, whether I should say to wrap up here, it was a...
oh, that was when I just got boring?
No. You. was I that obvious? No. No, I was... a couple of questions that I had. One was your middle name, Sweetwood. Was that from somebody that was a family member? Or?
No, and it isn't my real middle name.
I always thought it was Patrick Sweetwood Hazel.
It is. Well, it was used for a period of time.
Okay.
And that's where my company name came from,
yeah.
which is now Sweetwood Creative. But, you know, this is kind of a far-fetched story, but it's true.
Okay.
And nobody will probably hear it that it matters about. But I had gotten in trouble... I was in a car full of guys in high school.
Okay.
And, you know, we didn't feel like it was a policeman, but it was some authority figure, security guard or somebody came to the window of the car and had the rolled the window down. And I wanted to know our names.
Yeah.
And the guy before me used my name, used my last name, Hazel, okay. in his fake name.
Oh, in his fake
name. Yeah.
That's funny.
And now I didn't have a name.
Yeah.
I didn't have a name.
Because he already used your name.
And he didn't use my whole name.
Yeah, but...
He used his first name because I think the guy overheard it, and then he said his last name.
Yeah.
My last name. So we had come from a party and something of people we didn't know.
Yeah.
And walking down the stairs on the way out, there was a football jersey that had the last name Sweetwood on it.
Okay.
Sweetwood. For some reason, those big, bold letters on the back of that jersey, at the time, the guy goes, and what's your name? I'm like, Patrick Sweetwood. You know, like I was like making it up.
Yeah, as you're going.
And I was like, oh, man. Well, I thought that was a one-off. Well, every person in that car the next day at school, oh, Patrick Sweetwood, huh? Like it became this thing that they mocked me for my immature ability to come up with something. And so... then, because they were doing that to me, I can't remember. I played a place in Salina, Kansas. It was called the Smoky Hill River Festival in Salina, Kansas. And I don't know if they knew somebody from my high school or whatever, but I came into town and everywhere, welcome Patrick Sweetwood Hazel. the car dealership at the festival printed yeah. in the program, you know, it's sort of at that period, brief period of time,
yeah,
became the sort of fake middle name mm-hmm. that I didn't cringe, but I was like, oh, I didn't really set out for this to happen.
Especially in your professional life.
Well, so later when I started into the college market, there was a thing called NACA.
Sure.
Selling shows to the colleges. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be in a vanity Pat Hazel and a Pat Hazel production starring Pat Hazel. they said, you know, what's your company name? And I did the same. I go, Sweetwood Productions. I was like, it's already my go-to fake name. I may as well make this fake company, right? So I represented myself in the college market as Sweetwood Productions and had a booth, and I was the representative of it and all of that, you know. And if they would call me, they would talk to me. I didn't, you know,
you didn't do make a fake voice, fake they'll have them call you back or kind of a thing.
But I did like it. I did like having a business that was not my name because then people could feel like they could call there. Sometimes they don't want to talk to the artist directly, you know?
Yeah, they'd rather talk like with the agent, particularly if they have gotten a card that says Sweetwood Productions on it. And they're thinking, okay, well, I'm going to be calling this office. I'll talk with the agent or somebody. Right. And, yeah. So
I one of the brands I have is called The Good Humor Men, which are friends that have been all on The Tonight Show and were on Late Night and Stephen Colbert and things like that, right?
Yeah.
And I decided that I did make up a fake name of a fake representative.
Okay.
And it was Mike, and then M-I-K-E, and the last name was Stand, right? It was Mike Stand. But unless you said it out loud, it was just, and we would get calls at the company at the beginning.
Is Mr. Stand
Is Mike there? Yeah. No, they go, is Mike there? We go, nobody named Mike. We totally forgot that I had put that in the materials at the time. And we go, nope. And they go, oh, we were calling about this. Oh, hang on. It was like, oh, shit, somebody's got to be Mike now, you know. But, you know.
Yeah, hand the mic to Mike. let him talk.
Right.
That is funny.
Yeah.
And then finally.
To wrap up now.
Yes, to wrap up. As we start to get to my last question, there are more things I guess we could probably talk about as well. And if people who are listening to this want us to get back together again sometime to explore some more things.
Do you have something? Do you have a place they can comment and say never again? Or
I do.
We want the real dirt. Like, I haven't really revealed the secrets yet.
No, you haven't. That's why I was going to say, if we kind of get back together, that way that you can actually open up and not be quite so reluctant to actually speak behind a microphone, maybe that I can I can get you out and actually, you know, share some more stories.
Right.
I mean, you're such a quiet guy. Perhaps next time that we can talk more about Seinfeld, kind of behind, because, you know, it's interesting also when you did move to LA, I thought that was kind of funny because you were next door neighbors to the lady from Supergirl or Superman. What was her name?
Lois Lane. Terry Hatcher.
Terry Hatcher. Yeah. And that, I think I was with you one time then, whenever that you were buying, I was over at your house and you were sending her a gift, I think, for her birthday or something.
Huh.
She lived in the apartment next to you or
something. Yeah, no, we actually later wrote an episode of Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, together that was aired on ABC and have been longtime friends since then.
Yeah, and then also the movie that you were in, that you were in that cult film that people still refer to all
Which
the time.
Which one? Which cult film?
Well, I'm sure there were several here. The one
I mean, it's funny.
The one
there was
you
one.
Like you were a patron. You were kind
of. Oh, that was called Waiting.
Waiting. Yeah.
It's
Jennifer Aniston, wasn't that? I think was Jennifer Aniston in that one.
No, I know Ryan Reynolds was, and a guy named Justin Long and Dane Cook, and there were lots of sort of
people
young,
early
smart
at the time.
Asses. Yeah. I was just a straight-laced businessman.
And playing a funny part. And when I get, you know, then.
But it's funny. You took every movie appearance I ever had and put it together. It would be like on a dime-sized DVD. It's one or two lines in Glory Road, one or two lines in, you know, whatever. I mean, I did a series called Friday Night Lights for like five or six episodes.
You were a police officer.
I was a detective.
Yeah, detective.
And this is a very brief, funny story, which was that they used a lot of regular people sometimes, and they had already had a detective who was a real detective that was playing a role as a detective. And then they realized this guy can't act. He can't do this.
Yeah.
So they put a call out, and my representative at the time sent me on my lunch hour. I went and read, and on the way home, they called and said, you start tomorrow.
Just
so
like
I went to the set, and I went to the I don't know what they call those trailers, star trailer or whatever, and I opened the door with the character name on it, and the detective was in there. They had forgotten to get rid of the other guy.
Oh, gosh, that's awkward.
Right. So they're like, oh, hang on a second. Go get your hair cut and get in makeup. And the next thing you know, they gave me a new name, and I was this guy's boss. Mm-hmm. And the director said to me, well, they didn't have the heart to get rid of him.
They just phased out his lines.
Well, they didn't. I had the lines.
Yeah.
But they said, "Can you find a way during the scene to send him for coffee or for something?" Like, I basically was letting him go, but he was leaving the scene.
Wow.
Something.
You know? They didn't want
and
him
so
in.
Then 4 or 5 episodes later, when another detective was introduced, I'm like, I'm not going for coffee. I'm not getting any papers. I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving this room. You know?
And, you know, I've told you the story a lot of times before, too, but people who listen to this podcast don't know this, so I wanted to share the story about when you were leaving, and I was moving into Omaha, and you were heading to L.A., and you were having a big yard sale, that I got a gaming table, and you gave it to me, like, here's a housewarming gift since you're moving to Omaha.
Oh, okay.
Because you had 2 or 3 of these. It was a place that had gone out of business, I think.
Sure. I remember that.
Yeah, and to this day, I still have that, and that's what I use now as my dining room table, because I've made our dining room into a sitting room where people come to visit, and it's, that's what I eat on, and I think of you almost every day.
Wow, that's funny. I'm glad that went to good use.
It has, and so that's been, what, 40 years?
I mean, I probably should have charged you then. Yeah. I didn't know it was going to last that long. Well, I do remember that a couple of the, I wouldn't call them stalkers, but a couple of the regular people that came to my close-up magic in the old market found out I had a garage sale. There was a couple of sisters that wore Elvis t-shirts and whatever. And I don't know, for some reason they were enamored by me.
Yeah.
And when they came up to my garage sale, I was like, oh no, they're going to buy all my old crap and put it in their house. Like, oh, I don't know.
You'll have a Pat Hazel room.
I don't know. Yeah, that's like a, you know,
creepy.
One of your greatest fears.
And did they buy stuff?
They did buy stuff. And I was like, oh, if they're buying it, you know.
Yeah.
And then I threw in stuff. I was like, take that and then get out of here. Like, take all of that, whatever you want, before I give it to
Goodwill. Underwear and socks. I know it's what you really want. So, take that and you're out of here. And then finally, to wrap, I do call this the Magic Word Podcast, and I always like to know what the magic word is. What is it that is your philosophy? You know, it could be a phrase, sentence, not necessarily a word, and it's something that's important to you. So what is it you live by? In other words, when you wake up, what drives you for that day? I mean, I know that you're always up and at 'em and busy and thinking of the next best thing or whatever. But anyhow, what is it that is important?
Well, I have a couple of new philosophies, but I'll give you one of them.
Yep.
And it kind of, I use it in my, I'm writing a musical with a guy as well. It's called Grounded for Life. And in this musical, the Grounded for Life premise is that, what if somebody was really grounded for life? So there's a guy stuck in his childhood bedroom and hasn't moved on. And it's sort of an analogy for being stuck in a marriage, being stuck in a job, being stuck in anything in life where you're not proactive, right?
Right.
So it's a farcical scenario. But in the middle of this story, the guy is faced with death. He's choking on a piece of bacon, and he's in the room alone, and the smoke fills the room, and then the hooded, you know,
figure
death with the scepter comes in. And he has a chance to talk with him. And it's kind of like It's a Wonderful Life or Scrooge or something, where the guy thinks he's going to see his whole life shown to him in front of him.
Right.
And so they stand up on the toy box together and look out at the room. And the guy says, I don't see the vision. I don't see. He goes, no, you do. This is it.
Oh.
You've made no impact on the world.
Wow.
You have no. I mean, it's kind of like you've wasted your whole life.
Yeah.
Okay. So the grounded guy gets a chance to ask death a question, right? So he says, he wants to know what the key to happiness is. And death says, good news, bad news. The bad news is there's no key to happiness. But the good news, it's not locked.
Wow.
And that is sort of the underlying premise of the whole play, which is quit blaming everybody, quit thinking that you're being held in place. You're the warden of any unhappiness, right, that you have. Mm-hmm. You are free. It's unlocked. You're unshackled at all times, right?
You're the only person holding yourself down.
Yeah, that's it, you know. And I mean, I think we know it. I think human beings, the human condition, it takes a while to sort of own that we self-sabotage and we do whatever. But I think, you know, that's from my previously written show, but I think it actually pointed towards the new show I'm writing, right? The true north is face your fears. Like, own whatever it is that you need to do to move forward or whatever. Because I think that sort of makes you an unstoppable, like, if you're not afraid of stuff, you know, Warren Buffett is not afraid to invest in things. It's a risk to reward. He's used to doing research and finding out who owns the company, who manages the company. You know, he doesn't, you know, go for the new sexy technology. He goes for toothpaste and toilet paper, and
just like
people are going to wipe their ass the rest of their life.
Right.
There's money in that.
Right.
Now that sounds like my magic word, but you know, take either one.
Okay.
People are going to wipe their ass the rest of their life, right? So invest. Two-ply.
In two-ply. Good advice, and I thank you very much. It's been fantastic spending time with you. I'm sure everybody's going to enjoy this.
I hope so. So sad.
And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Pat Hazel. This is Scotty out. Ah, oh, Pat kills me. I love the guy. I hope you do too. And I hope you enjoy these two special episodes, of part one and part two. If you're just tuning in and heard part two, then you missed part one. You've definitely got to go back and hear the first part of this then as well. A lot of really great stories and just a wonderful human being and gentleman and father, comedian, performer, creator, producer, a little bit of everything. My gosh, what a guy. So if you get a chance to see him, tell him that you enjoyed hearing him on the Magic Word Podcast. And also, I do want to again say happy birthday to Bruce Leash. Thank you for being a sponsor and for listening to our podcast from week to week. And I want to thank each of you for coming back each week and listening to this podcast then as well. If you have not yet subscribed to the newsletter, please do go over to themagicwordpodcast.com and subscribe now. Well, we have one more episode left before we reach the monumental milestone of 500, and that's going to be a really good one next week, and our guest is going to be announced in that newsletter that you should be subscribing to. And so until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to invest in 2-ply. This is Scotty out.